Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.
Hi, I'm Dahlia Lithwick, legal correspondent, author, and host of Slate's Amicus Podcast, a show about the rule of law, the law, and the Supreme Court justices who interpret it for the rest of us. I've been watching the High Court for over two decades, and I bring all that experience and knowledge to examining the U.S. justice system and democracy. Each episode, I am joined by guests with deep knowledge of the law and policy who help me and you navigate our constitutional landscape. Slate's Amicus Podcast. Subscribe now wherever you listen.
Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday. Today, my guest is Ben McKenzie, author of the new book, Easy Money, Cryptocurrency, Casino Capitalism, and the Golden Age of Fraud. This book is an incredibly fast-paced, relatable story. Ben is joined by journalist Jacob Silverman, and together they take us on this journey into the very dark side of crypto. Is there a bright side? I don't know. You be the judge. You don't need any kind of expertise to follow along. Plus, even if you've been around the Bitcoin block before, you will appreciate the jaw-dropping encounters they have with the key players in crypto, including FTX CEO Sam Bankman-Fried before his indictment and extradition, and Celsius CEO Alex Mashinsky before his indictment, who admitted to Ben at South by Southwest in early 2022 the scope of the scam. Mashinsky said that only about 10 to 15% of the crypto system was real money. Everything else, he said, is just bubble. Ben has been an outspoken critic of cryptocurrency for a long time. Perhaps you saw him on C-SPAN in December of 2022 when he testified before the Senate Banking Committee for a hearing on the topic, The Crypto Crash, Why the FTX Bubble Burst, and the Harm to Consumers. During the hearing, Ben called FTX the biggest Ponzi scheme in history and told the senators that the 40 million Americans who have invested in crypto have been lied to in ways both big and small by a once seemingly mighty crypto industry whose entire existence, in fact, depends on misinformation, hype, and fraud. Not a fan of C-SPAN? You may also know Ben McKenzie from network television, the big screen, or more recently in his 2020 Broadway debut. He starred as Ryan Atwood on the teen drama The OC and as James Gordon in the hit series Gotham. I can't list all of his movies, but I will say his first one, Junebug, is a favorite. Okay, let's dive in. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
I am good. Are you?
Sorry I was 5 minutes late. I usually use Safari, and then I had to get Chrome, and then I had to update my Chrome. And I was like, I don't know how to do it. It's very funny, but I don't know anything about technology.
Well, if you have children, that's why what they're there for. They can usually do the tech.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Bring in my seven-year-old.
Wait. You are saying you know nothing about...
Yeah. Yep.
Tech. Yep. And yet you wrote probably the best book I've ever read on, not that there have been that many, but on cryptocurrency. The best thing I've ever read on this. This is such a good book. And I don't say that lightly. It's fantastic. The way you link together not just this complete meltdown in the crypto world, but that, you know, that you reminded us and linked it back to the 2008 crisis and yet got all of that correct. Plus your whole discussion about how Bitcoin, et cetera, really should have been classified as securities. You know, I teach securities regulation. So right. I'm like, oh, yes, this is, I mean, I loved your book. It was entertaining. It was accurate. And if you can believe it, I actually have read it, even though it just came out 2 days ago.
Yeah, that was fast. Wow, that's great. I'm so flattered. I mean, it is a book podcast, so if you don't read the book. Have you ever faked it, Jen? Be honest with me.
You mean never read, didn't even read it? No.
Yeah, of course. You have to do it. You have integrity. There are other people who I may have spoken to who I'm pretty sure did not.
You could do the, you could quiz me. You could just like throw out a name and I'll see if I know.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying.
Do it. No.
This
fucking
is my
do
way.
It. Do it, Ben.
Well,
give
I'm
me anything.
Ask you some questions. What were your
ask
favorite?
Ask me some. Okay.
They're going to be hard hitting. They're going to be hard hitting questions. What were your
no,
favorite?
No, ask me. What?
What were your favorite parts? What was your favorite? What were some of your favorite parts?
Oh, that's not a hard hitting question. I thought you wanted
no,
to.
No, that's, I'm, you know what okay. I'm doing now.
Okay. No, I know you're throwing me softballs, but don't do that. Oh. I can tell you what was the market, the supposed not, you know, market value of crypto at its peak? I could fucking tell you that.
Tell
$3 trillion. $3 trillion.
Dude, nice
how much work. Bubble? How much bubble was in the system? Well, but Mashinsky thought there was only like 10 to 15% real money, honey.
Dude, you nailed it. That's
come
amazing.
On. I did my homework.
I know. Well, I mean, I should expect nothing less of you. The numbers are fascinating in crypto because they're so like bizarre, right? I mean, they made them up. I mean, it's really funny. People are like, well, what do you make of Bitcoin being worth $30,000? I'm like, well, you know, if you're buying it on a US exchange, I mean, Coinbase is going through its own troubles with SEC. Right. So like, we'll see, you know, they're being sued saying they aren't an exchange. We'll see if like, see what happens. But like, if you're here in America, and you're running through an exchange based here, like you probably have a pretty decent shot of getting your money out if you're trying to, I mean, probably. But the overseas ones are shady as hell. And so these numbers are just like, I mean, they're just completely ridiculous. It's pretty funny to try to tell the stories because, you know, we usually measure Ponzi's, or at least in popular opinion, we measure Ponzi's by what they say they were worth,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, the mm-hmm. number that everyone remembers of Mashinsky.
Madoff.
Excuse me. Bernie Madoff. Sorry.
That's all right.
Bernie Madoff is like $65 billion. But what they actually found, I think, was not anywhere near that. But I think it was in the 20s, I think.
Yeah, it was something like $20 billion. And they did an incredible job of the trustee deciding how they were going to, you know, how they were going to allocate and get people not made whole, but some money back. You know, I think the hardest, what I want to do, because I think the hardest thing for people who hear the words crypto or Bitcoin or FTX or Binance or any of this stuff is they get really confused with two types. One, they get really confused or they act like they're know-it-alls. And I think, to me, I think finally, after reading this book, I think that maybe the best way to make it more clear is to forget about the blockchain piece of it.
Yes. Yes. You did it.
Okay. Right? So I think if anyone doesn't
it's an old technology. It doesn't work very well.
Okay. So let's just forget. So look, if everyone's wondering, what is cryptocurrency? It's specifically Bitcoin. We would say, imagine, what was the number again of how many, they limited how many, Bitcoins were, what was it, outer limit?
21 million is the number.
Okay. So this is the idea. Imagine you have, you wrote on a piece of paper in front of you the number 21 million. And for those of you who aren't good at numbers, that's a 21, comma, 000, comma, 000. That's 21 million, right?
Yep.
That's how many they promised. Ha ha. You don't even know if they're going to keep the promise. But the promise is we're going to create 21 million essentially pieces of Monopoly money. It'd be the equivalent of, we get some special, imagine, look at this. This is just, I'm holding up now like a post-it note. But imagine instead of a 3M post-it note with stripes, this was some special kind of paper that no one had. Oh, you got yours.
I do it.
Ben's
do it.
Got his 21. Right, he's special it. Paper. No one can get this paper, but instead of paper, it's like digital points, like you're playing, you know, a game on the computer. There's 21 million of these points, period. And there are limited supply of them, but they're not going to give them out all right away. And they can be used only to buy things within this imaginary world. Like, so if we imagine for a second the world were Twitter or Facebook or it was some other world that you participate online. There are 21 million of these, not given out right away, but the main use for them is to trade them among people And then when people, because there's a limited amount, they don't let them out right away, hard to get them right away, that people got really excited and they're going to trade back and forth. Plus, am I getting this next part right? You could also, because it was pseudonymous where people didn't use their real names, you could also do things like buy drugs or do other illegal things with them.
Yeah, which by the way, I just want to say really quick before you move on.
Yeah.
I like drugs. So I don't want to say that in a bad, no, I don't, probably not the same drugs they were buying, but I just want to say,
yeah,
for what it's worth too.
I should say illegal. I mean, there's nothing in Massachusetts, cannabis is fully legal. So I'm not, you know, and people take a lot of medications to stabilize themselves. I'm not saying that drugs.
Sorry, I was making a joke, but also.
Yeah, but Silk Road. Okay, so if there's 20 million of these things, not all distributed, but people could use this play money. It's almost like when you're a little kid and you'd have play money, but you only have to exchange it online. And then the other thing that you could do with them, in theory, is convert them from the play imaginary world system into the real world. Yes. In other words, it was hard to use. Not many people would take them unless they were part of the Bitcoin or other crypto world. But the dream would be you got one of these 21 million before there were 21 million out there. And instead of being, you know, the dollar or whatever you bought it for, it got up to $20,000. And you thought, oh, shit, I made millions of dollars. I'd like to cash that out into a real bank account so I can buy stuff in the real world, like pay my rent, buy myself some fancy perfume and shoes and go out to dinner, etc. That's not the use case. But do I have this right so far?
Yeah. You're getting a lot of it. I mean, you're getting everything you're saying right. There's so many different ways to explain it. This is a great way to explain it.
Okay. So the thing I think that gets people confused, I think people want to confuse them, is the thing where I started out with saying, you know, these people, whoever they were there was going to be, there was this idea that there's going to be 21 million of these things at most. The thing that got confusing is that in order to get these monies, these bitcoins, let's say, instead of like going to a job and, you know, serving people Starbucks and they pay you your $15 an hour and you get them and it gets directly deposited in your bank account the way our money does, with this kind of money, you had to, and this is the stupidest fucking thing I've ever heard of, you had to go use a lot of computing power.
Yes.
To go solve puzzles. And then if you solve the algorithmic puzzle, you could earn some of these monies. Okay. Yes. Okay. So that part is crazy. There's this other part about the distributed ledger. I don't even need to get into that. So that's what Bitcoin and all these coins are at the most basic level. Now that we've got that, I want you now, since you are the expert, to tell me why it was that you realized what the biggest problems were in terms of converting that into real dollars and why everyone said they were doing this crypto to help poor people in poor countries have money.
I'm sorry, you cut out in the middle, and I.
I'm sorry.
You can hear me, and so I missed probably 20 seconds.
I'm going to start where I said. I think a bit earlier. Okay, so this is imaginary money. Why is this imaginary money, whether it's 21 million bitcoins or some other kind of virtual currency? Why did people actually decide that they wanted to put real money into this? Mm. How hard was it for them to convert this back into the real money system? And why did you think this was a scam and no one believed you at first?
Okay. Well, okay. Those are all great questions. There's a lot of them. So if when I forget the second one, remind me.
Okay.
I promise. The first one was, what's the first one?
The first one is, why did people believe that this
was real money? Yeah. How did it sort of gain? Yeah. So I tried to do a brief synopsis of sort of the industry as I saw it. You know, you're not talking about a ton of time. You're talking about the Bitcoin white paper came out in October of 2008, at the height of the subprime crisis. And these people, Satoshi Nakamoto, we don't know who this person or people are. They used a pseudonym, of course. I'm not saying that immediately makes it suspicious, but it does. They released this thing that said it's going to be a peer-to-peer currency and avoid all intermediaries. And so, you know, it obviously the story has appeal because banks were even more unpopular than they usually are.
Right.
But it took a while for it to take off because you're right. How do you, if it doesn't really do anything, how do you ascribe value? So Silk Road was the first onboarding mechanism, major one. You know, that's the dark web marketplace. It was drugs. It was also like weapons and trafficking. And anyway, the Fed shut it down because...
So let me just back it up there, and I promise to keep us on track with the questions. When you say Silk Road, so there were people who, if you wanted to buy weapons on this dark web website, or you wanted to buy narcotics or prostitutes or whatever you wanted to do, people on that would accept this Bitcoin for payment, is what you're saying.
Yeah, because they wanted to make sure that, you know, they couldn't get, you know, jailed for it, right? They didn't want to, you weren't trying to use the pseudonymity of the blockchain to allow you to do, you know, stuff that's not legal.
So that comes into the real world then. Like, I'm on this dark web, I know it doesn't exist, and I order some kind of narcotic, and I give up some of these Bitcoins that I've mined, in whatever account I have. Now, I have fewer of them, but then at my doorstep in the mail, my drugs show up in the real world.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was the first big onboarding mechanism. Then the Fed shut that down. Then it kind of languished for a while. Then Ethereum came out, which is this other cryptocurrency. The second biggest one. And it's a little bit different, and it has open source code where people can create their own cryptos off of it. And it's pretty easy to do so, is my understanding. I am not a cryptographer. I am not a computer scientist. I am just a guy who knows about money.
But it's kind of like people making a social media site. Like, everyone's making a social media site, right?
It's not that difficult once the base code has been set up. So off of Ethereum, just thousands and thousands of cryptocurrencies, I guess hundreds initially, and then because people could basically create their own, you know, knockoff versions of Bitcoin. And right there, because they're being used as investments, you're not buying Dogecoin because you think you can use Dogecoin for anything in the real world, right? I mean, Bitcoin is hard enough, but think of like these obscure coins. It's an investment, and people were, you know, running all kinds of things that in regulated markets wouldn't happen. So there's a big crest of that in 2017, 2018, or 2016, 2017, where it was called the ICO craze, initial coin offering craze. And that was a big bubble. And if you've heard of Bitcoin and crypto, I mean, look, who knows? But
let me back up, though. I know you know this so well, but I just want to make sure. I was describing and I was imagining the story people were telling, that this is just currency. Like you said, use case was people could buy things on Silk Road using this. But you're saying, though, actually people weren't.
Well, then it became. The story changes. So you know, the person that I cite as often as I can in the book is the person whose work has influenced me the most, which is Robert Shiller, the economist who talks about how economic narratives form and their response to real events, the subprime crisis, arguably in this case, although I go into another theory at the end of the book that maybe even that is not true, but their response to real events, and then he describes them as like viruses. They can change and evolve and mutate depending on the need for a different story. And so the story evolved and changed and mutated. It was originally, currency, peer-to-peer, that didn't really work. Then it was for drugs. Then it was basically financial speculation. You know, you could like buy a coin and hope to make money because the coin's price went up. Anyway, it created this big wave that, of course, crashed. And then that went away for a while, and then it got resuscitated, late 2020, early 2021. Mm-hmm. It really just took off like madness. And I could go into the weeds on, because I didn't really quite have enough time and energy and focus I had enough time, energy, and focus. I thought the reader would be bored if I went
into... No, you did the right level. You know what? You did the exact right level of specificity. If you get too granular... It's not helpful. Anyone can go on the internet and go dig deeper. You went to the right explanatory level.
Thank you. So I guess I was just about to say that for reasons that I don't think are worth like going into too much, but I'll just state some obvious ones. Like, obviously, there's some truth to the fact that during COVID, people were at home or wherever they live. They were isolated. Mm-hmm. They had been given money, stimulus payments, loans, you know, it was easy money, right? The powers that be, the Fed and the government, you know, understandably were worried the economy was going to grind to a halt. So they did, I mean, We can definitely argue about whether they did it well, but they, you know, they pumped trillions of dollars into the economy. And so people were bored and depressed, and they were told that this was going to make them rich. And so they were gambling with it. I mean, that's what it is. It's just gambling.
And you talk a lot about, I think this is right, these kind of communities that develop, even if they're fake communities, there's a sense of, we were so isolated. We are isolated as people, even without COVID. Yeah. And people, as you note in your book, some people like to gamble. They like to play games on the internet. And this was gambling, and it was a game, and it was a community. And specifically, it was in particular mostly a place for men to form community. And men don't get to always form that much kind of community. I mean, I guess, I'm not a man, so I don't know what their lives
are
like.
You're absolutely right.
It's hard to make friends and bond.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll speak to that. Like,
I just think
we need to be honest about what these things are, and so because I'm a man, I can talk about it, at least from my own point of view. I'm obviously not every man. I'm just a man.
Oh, you are, Ben. You are every man. isn't that true? I mean, okay. I just want to boost up your confidence. You are. You're the best man in the world. But anyway, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Well, you should. Can you talk to my wife? Men are self-isolating, I think. Women are too, but I think men have a certain tendency. They also really like. Men are more risk tolerant. Young men are more risk tolerant than almost any segment of the population. And so they do gamble more, you know, young men gamble more. I go into a lot of the similarities between online poker, which took off in the 2000s, and crypto, if you wanted the shorthand, crypto is basically online poker 2.0, but just with, you know, more crime, and bigger. But men gamble. There's nothing, you know, I started off, I used to like to play poker with friends, but I like to play in person. I was in my 20s. I was living in Los Angeles. I was single. And it was a way, I had a house and I could invite guys over and we would have beers. It was my house, so I wasn't driving, so I could have as many as I wanted. And we'd play cards, and I'd usually lose. I'm not very good at it, but it was fun. And at some point I grew out of that, but like the communities that you couldn't literally do that during COVID, right? You couldn't literally go to a casino for a while. Right.
Right.
And then these they're gamified in a way that I think encourages a certain, like creates certain, you know, stimuli, activates certain stimuli in your brain and kind of gives you that sense of like endorphin rush, you know,
right.
You're making, you know, it's green, red, you're making money, you're losing money. And that high is very intoxicating. You know, we talked to gambling experts in this book, for the book, and apparently, you know, gambling addiction is quite a serious addiction, and often not discussed because men, of course, don't like to admit when they're addicted to it, because it's very embarrassing. The average gambler loses, and you know, to fess up to that, especially if you're really into it and you've lost a lot of money, is really difficult.
I won't give away too much in the book, but there is one, I think it's probably fine to talk about the story of that man talking about his father, the minister, and his father, who just got in so deep and was so embarrassed and ashamed and couldn't get out. And that's what was so interesting and very new to me is how you describe that kind of culture. Like, yeah, everyone gets cheated, whatever, but do your own research. What is that acronym again?
DYOR. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's this, I have a student, I've had several students over the years that, you know, when I teach securities regulation, I knew this thing was getting big because they all want to write a paper about it, right? Yeah. About crypto. And how it should or shouldn't be regulated. And we can talk about whether you think regulators missed it or they were just trying to avoid making it look legit by not regulating the whole space. But you know, there's this way that one of my students was like, yeah, you know, I lost some money on Binance, right? Like they act slightly sheepish, but like it's, oh, well, that's just what happens in the in crypto. But like your interview with Sam Bankman-Fried, when he said, yeah, a million people are going to lose money, lose all their, and it is nonchalant when he tells you this.
It's crazy. Guys will say this all the time in crypto. They'll be like, they're growing pains. I'm like, that's people. You're talking about people, right? And their lives, potentially.
Right.
Like, and thank God in crypto, most people didn't bet more than they could afford to lose. But some people bet everything.
Right.
They were lied to. Like, Celsius is a really good example. So Celsius, I interviewed this guy named Alex Mashinsky, who's the CEO of a crypto firm. They called themselves a crypto bank. And basically, like, you give them your crypto, and they give you this incredible return on your money, guaranteed, like 18% or something insane. And they're like, we're fighting back against the banks. Like, we can't tell you exactly how we're getting this return, but, like, you know, we're going to, you know, you're going to make money, and where it's the community and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, look, dude, we can all say, look, that's obviously a scam. I can't believe people. But, like, honestly, we all think we're smarter than we are. Let's be honest.
That's so true. And let me just say, though, you know, and you know this, but I don't think people realize once you had whatever kind of, whether it was a Bitcoin or a Dogecoin or whatever have you, these were very hard. You couldn't just like go to an ATM and get your and convert it into your real bank account, right? So when someone says to you, give me what you have, and I'll give you 18%. Of course, red flags go off for you and I, but how else were you going to get it out of the system?
Great point.
It was very hard.
That's right. And so it becomes this like never ending loop of like, you know, people kind of trying to make more of it because they couldn't use it. And people swallowed it too. People believe, you know. And so anyway, so Celsius went bankrupt and he's being sued for fraud by the New York, Mashinsky's being sued for fraud by the New York AG, and he was arrested last week and charged with fraud by the DOJ. But, you know, 300,000 people apparently gave their money to Celsius. And the testimonials are now coming out in the bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And they're just brutal. They're just brutal. Because you're talking about, like, you know, people that are living on pensions, you know, people that, like, put their life savings into it. And to your point, like, it's sort of interesting because like a lot of people are like, well, you know, yeah, I lost a little money, but, and I get that. And you should count yourself lucky, but just know that like, and I'm not trying to make you feel bad about it. I'm not saying you did anything wrong. I totally get it. I almost invested. I get it. But the money you put into it means that it has value, which allows criminals to then use it for their own ends and defraud people. Like if nobody bought it eventually, which, you know, it's a story, so it'll last forever unless we outlaw it because people will believe in it whether it's true or not. But as long as there's real money in there, there's real money to be used for all sorts of criminal activity. So in a way, you're providing liquidity for them. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Like it's, I totally know.
Yeah, that's the sort of...
Well, it's like the early people on the Ponzi scheme. You know, anyone who gives money into a Ponzi scheme to pay off earlier investors is keeping the thing going, is what you're saying too.
Yeah, and you know, people say, well, I made money on it. I'm like, okay, like I'm not pro people losing money, and I'm not anti people making money. I'm just talking about the structure of the thing. It's zero sum. That means it literally cannot produce a positive sum return.
What's interesting to me is the paradigms, the different paradigms that you go through in the book. About this, let me say it the way you said it. What Robert Shiller had said, the different narratives around this, right? Yeah. One narrative could be, oh, this is currency. This is like money. And the other narrative is, well, this is an investment. And, you know, investments are risky. And it's very weird how people who promoted this kind of tried to have it both ways. And
yes.
The trouble you point out is, and this is because you were an econ major, you know, like, if for something to be actual money, it needs to be a medium of exchange. You need to buy goods and service with it. It also needs to be a store of value, you know. And finally, it's supposed to be a unit of account. Like, you know, okay, so you know how to, you know, keep your books if you have a business, or you know if you are making money or losing money on something. That's what a unit of account would be. And the thing is, crypto is terrible. Like, as we mentioned, it can't buy many things, so it's not a very good medium of exchange. In terms of a store of value, it's so volatile. It's not great. And it's not a really good unit of account for all those reasons. And then in terms of, so, but then the other narrative you talk about, which is, I think it's closer to what it is. It's an investment contract, right? Like you talk about the Howey test, which we teach. It's a person who invests their money in a collective enterprise, you know, where they'll expect a profit based on the efforts of others. But if it's a security, then the SEC should have been regulating this from day one and treated it like an unregistered security. And I don't know why they didn't.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
I never got a satisfying answer to that question. You know, obviously this was well before I started investigating. We're talking about, I can't remember if it's 2014 or 2015, but the CFTC in a, so the Commodities Future Trading Commission, which regulates commodities. And let's just start with actually something that's very important for people to understand, which I did not appreciate until I needed to understand how we got here. We're the only country in the world that separates our securities regulation from our commodities regulation in the way that we do. We've created two separate regulatory bodies, the CFTC that does commodities, the SEC that does securities, and they are overseen by different committees in the House and the Senate, which creates different incentives. We can talk about that in a minute. And there's a gray area between how we classify commodities and securities. Or at least arguably. And so in 2014 or 2015, futures were being traded of Bitcoin, futures contracts, like the ability to buy and sell at a certain price in the future. And under a strict reading of the Commodity Exchange Act of 1936, anything that there were futures for, you could call a commodity if it had not been classified as a security. So the CFTC said, yeah, you know, Bitcoin falls under our jurisdiction. And it was such a small market at that point because Silk Road had been shut down. And so I think it just kind of flew under the radar and people didn't really think about it, I would guess. I don't know exactly how it went down. That'd be an interesting subject book too.
Right.
But these other things, and there are reasons that you could also think of, it's hard to tell who the exact. So a security has an issuer, the person that issues the stock, like the
exactly.
company, right?
Right, right.
And with Bitcoin, because you're talking about Satoshi Nakamoto, like you don't know who that person or people are. So that's a thing that they can argue makes it more like a commodity. Also, they can say the limited supply, 21 million Bitcoin, makes it more like a commodity.
Right.
But anyway, enough of a reasoning. So it became, but then these other things exploded. And yeah, the SEC, I mean, it's interesting. Like, it's messy. The application of the law is messy. It takes time. They've definitely sued people, for sure.
For the ICOs, the ICOs. Because those are more like, the ICOs, these initial coin offerings, are more like funding a company, going public with a company, but issuing coins instead of stock. So that's closer to a traditional security, yeah.
And then they sort of found a way around that. And sort of ended up doing, you know, a similar thing.
Can I just go back to what you're saying? Because it's really, it's interesting, the part about how you say in the U.S., we separate the regulation of what we would consider a security versus a commodity, as well as derivatives built off of those. But there's it's not just an intellectual difference in terms of the crypto world really wanted, as you note in the book, the CFTC to be their regulator and not the SEC. Right. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's called regulatory arbitrage, right? You're trying to basically find the weaker regulatory agency. And the CFTC is about a quarter of the budget, has about a quarter of the budget, the SEC, and it's always been the smaller agency. And you're sort of, so you're trying to get the agency that like is smaller, and like there's an incentive for regulators to want more turf. Because there's such a revolving door in Washington, you go from the CFTC to private practice to you know, a position, maybe even in a crypto company and back. And this happens at the SEC too. But like, you know, there were some bad incentives from an armchair economist. You could just see the incentive structures were not well placed there. And we go
because
into
that. If you go light, if you encourage yes. light touch, then it's easier to get either return to or for the first time get a, you know, 6 or 7 figure salary working yeah. in a law firm or a company.
Right. And because crypto hadn't been, you know, kind of, well, we could also talk about, there's not really a lot of incentive for people to debunk crypto, right? People inside of crypto want to say it's the most amazing thing ever, particularly people in the industry, because their jobs depend on it and they've made money on it. People outside of it don't have a tendency to like have much reason to criticize it. So what they wanted, what, like, for a good example is Sam Bankman-Fried was on Capitol Hill a lot trying to convince regulators that he knew how to clean it up. He was going to make it great. And, you know, he's a kid from Stanford. His parents are professors of law at Stanford. Like, he went to MIT. He worked on Wall Street. Like, he presents a very good image of that. He was making a lot of success. I think Americans will be shocked to know how close we came to crypto getting further embedded in our regulated financial system, which I think would have
been... That is awesome. The big... And that's such a good point.
It was terrifying.
That's terrifying at how much... I know. I just...
So there's a bill, I think maybe now it's dead or they've rebranded it, but there was a bill at the House Ag Committee, which oversees the CFTC, and it was affectionately known as Sam's Bill. Like he called it, like, because he'd helped write it, or his people had helped write it. So that's how bad it got. Thankfully, you know, his empire fell apart before it could get worse.
Well,
like, it really was, we were pretty close. It was pretty bad.
I mean, this is the whole thing. And this is where, again, an insight in your book, which is, and picking up off what you said, this little world of not just the, you know, 21 million Bitcoins, but all the other pretend money, you know, when people are kind of in their own little world, playing their own little game, you know, it doesn't spill over into the rest of the world. It seems fine. But the trouble is, if that little game you're playing, that sort of bigger and bigger Ponzi scheme, needs more marks, needs more, a bigger, you know, the greater fool theory, you need someone else to buy the thing from you at a higher price so you can keep making money. That's why they needed to get the blessing of Congress and the regulators, so that people, so institutions like the big banks and that are regulated by, you know, the FDIC and by, you know, the Fed or by the OCC and my alphabets, you get the idea. We have
yeah,
this
yeah.
very, and so if you got the blessing, then the greater, who is the greater fool? Ordinary people who are going to buy into the Goldman Sachs coin,
right.
or
and you're
the
and you're literally,
my bank account.
You're literally doing the same thing that's up. Not literally. You're doing something that bears a striking resemblance to the subprime crisis.
And bears a resemblance to the crash of 1929.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's remarkable.
Just,
making the same mistake over again, but just calling it something else.
When my book came out, Big Dirty Money, and I did the rounds kind of like you're doing, not exactly like you're doing, I'm sure you're doing more, but I remember someone, you know, say to me, what's the next thing? And I'm like, it's crypto. You know, that's the, you know, but I feel bad about it. You know, I don't want anyone to lose money, but I'm really actually quite angry. In reading your book, I'm angry as much as I am impressed with the research because of the kinds of interviews that you did. I mean, not only did you do an incredible on-camera interview with Sam Bankman-Fried, but you also got that guy Mashinsky from Celsius, right? Yep. And you also went into an actual Bitcoin mining spot. You did all this cool stuff. People have to actually read the book to really appreciate this. But what made me angry and want to throw things is that people like Senator Gillibrand.
Yeah.
What? Is it Gillibrand or Gillibrand? Did I just pronounce it wrong?
I can't remember.
Anyway, Senator Gillibrand was supporting this nonsense. I'm glad I didn't support her candidacy for presidency. I mean, what in the world?
It was like not just encouraging it, but her and Senator Loomis of Wyoming, who, you know, famously had laser eyes in her Twitter profile for a while. I mean, you're a sitting U.S. senator. Like, dear Lord.
Oh. I forgot to ask you about the laser eyes because I love the cover of your book. People, first of all, you just have to buy Ben's book. just buy it. Don't even stop listening to the podcast. The book is called Easy Money, Cryptocurrency, Casino Capitalism, and the Golden Age of Fraud. I think you should buy it. You should give it to regardless of your gender, but especially if you know any men. They need to read this. Absolutely love this book. That's my pitch again. Just buy the damn book. Don't argue with me. It's called Easy Money. Now I even forgot after all of my pitches to you. But you were talking about how they. Oh, I know the eyes. So the cover of the book. I love it because in the first of all, the lettering is pretty cool in Easy Money. But then in the center is this circle where you have, you know, Benjamin Franklin from the $100 bill, but he's got laser eyes.
Yeah. It was such a good idea. It was not mine. I'll try to take partial credit for it. But Abrams Press is our publisher, who's been absolutely wonderful. They started with art books in the 50s. That was their initial success. And Abrams Press, their nonfiction imprint, is more recent, but they really do wonderful work with cover art. And they were asking for my thoughts, just sort of generally. They had like a form or something. And I said, I don't know, that's not my feel, but here's what, can you just try to do two things? Like, first is going to be the bad stuff. No gold, no code. Please let's not do, because God, if you look,
oh, gosh.
If you search crypto,
zeros and ones, yeah,
zeros
no.
and ones, and it's like, oh, but embrace the bananas art of crypto, embrace mm-hmm. the like, so it's this really aggressive green color that I love. I mean, it's the color of money, but it's also like it's a slightly different. And then there's the laser eyes and the juxtaposition of Franklin and laser eyes. So when they showed it to me, I was like, yes, like you got it. This is awesome. It's really satisfying. I hadn't appreciated the visual element of a book yet, actually, to be honest with you, until I had one. And I was like, wow, this is tricky to pull off. It can be done wrong. Like,
yeah, no, it's great. And what is I don't really fully know where the laser eyes thing came from.
Yeah, you know what? You asked me that question, or you mentioned it that you might ask me, and I actually was like, wait, I know that story? And so I looked it up. I think it was just a meme. I don't, like, most of the stuff just starts, so it's really kind of unclear.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know what I mean? You know, for example, like a good example of this is, so there's a phrase in crypto called HODL, hold on for dear life, but it was actually just somebody apparently misspelling hold on, because it's H-O-D-L, so it's misspelled. But it was actually just someone who was trying to say hold, mm-hmm. as opposed to the entire phrase. So, like, crypto is full of this kind of stuff, where, like, this mythology, like, comes about, but it's so silly.
But that's the thing. This reminds me also, and we haven't talked about .com, but this has a lot of the feel of that fun, disruptive .com culture. You know, right after I got out of law school, and I remember I was working at a company that was internet, web focused. And there was something about the people in that world that was like, we were young and we didn't have to, you know, you remember the, I'm sure if you don't know about this, but like people, you know, you go to work and there's no office spaces. Everyone has an open, you know, space or no more cubicles and you can like play pool or sit around and I don't know, whatever. You know, it was just my, and I, what?
Get high. No, not at work.
Yeah. Again, there we go with it. Yeah. No, but it's like, that's the, like, that has this, I feel like it comes out of that same that same flavor, and people felt, and people really did make money. I mean, the dot-com crash was real, but people made a ton of money. Everything wasn't pets.com. And so I think—
Totally. Well, and the internet, of course, was a revolutionary technology, is a revolutionary technology, as evidenced by the fact that I'm using it right now to talk to you. And so crypto, I think, like, you're right, similar cultural thing, young people, like, those young people. Like, I feel like so old when I say that. But younger folks who were excited about this thing that seemed to be, you know, that was gaining momentum and was being sold as all of these other things. And the cultural side, I think, just sort of naturally follows, where now the version is like, you know, social media and stuff like that. It's also a great way of selling crypto because—
Oh, yes.
Because it's sort of similar. It's very similar to a multi-level marketing scheme. And I make a kind of a joke about it, but like the Tupperware, the hours-long Tupperware party of the 50s or the Mary Kay Cosmetics or whatever has been replaced by a 60-second TikTok video, because you don't actually even need to know these people. They need to know you, but you can do this stuff through social media that's basically peer-to-peer in a way, but, right, but through a filter, you know, scaled through a filter of social media. I've heard crypto described as Mary Kay for men, which always made me chuckle.
How did you figure out— let me say it differently. You came in as a skeptic, and that was a really lonely place to be, because when you're a skeptic, you can be criticized, questioned, you may question yourself. And yet the key characters that you interviewed for this book, you have like the golden touch. Some of them have been indicted. So is anyone said to you, hey, Ben, you were right? Or is no one— are they still holding on
You mean inside of crypto? Oh, just in—
yeah, inside of crypto. Has anyone inside of crypto said, yeah, this whole thing was a flipping Ponzi scheme?
I've had multiple people who used to work in the industry tell me that. I don't go into them in the book because I'm trying to protect— I want to protect their identities.
Sure.
Obviously not comfortable, then they should do— I shouldn't, you know. But multiple people who are like, I worked in it and it was really bad. And there's one story. I'll tell you later, but I can't,
it's all right.
Holy crap, was it a great story. And so people know, you know, a lot of people know what was going on. It's kind of an open secret in a way. I mean, I was sort of amazed with how the line between like, oh, too bad they lost money, they learned a lesson, quickly turned into like, yeah, what a shame, you know, kind of like this wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of thing. I mean, the Mashinsky thing was crazy. I asked him the question I always ask these guys, because they always want to talk about people that made money. And so I was like, what are people that lost money, got scammed or defrauded? And the smart ones go, that's a shame, DYOR, blah, blah, blah. Mashinsky, he goes, you leave your money on the street, you're surprised it's gone when you come back? I'm like, what are you, seriously, dude? That's so sketchy. Like, what the heck? Anyway, yeah.
That's so intense. And his wife was a piece of work, too. Well,
she's a piece of work. At one point, she was being attacked by— they were being, you know, people were really ticked off because they went bankrupt first, like very shortly after I interviewed him, like, 3-4 months, 4 months. And because, you know, a lot of these things started collapsing very quickly once the real money— people were trying to get real money out and it really wasn't there. And, you know, that's kind of awkward. And this woman who was a Celsius member of the community, had invested money with them, couldn't get it out, and was ticked and was using social media to push back. And Mashinsky's wife, like, she was joking, but she's like, I'm gonna set you up with her. Like, she was trying to set us up on a date, was her like joke. It was one of the weirdest— I'm like, these people are really odd. Like, she has a clothing line company, and the clothing line company— it was the original tagline of the company was unbank yourself, right? Like don't
get out of the real banking, traditional banking system.
Come over to us, because we're better. And then they went bankrupt. And there were shirts made, apparently by them, by that company, that was unbankrupt yourself. They made that shirt, is what it appears to. That is— I don't understand. We're past humor. We're in a very weird space.
Well, you know, what bothered me the most is the, you know, the, I think that these folks probably say, you know, in the worst case, I go to jail. So I'm sure they've put their money away in some offshore bank account somewhere because, you know, you mentioned who, I forgot who said it, but they said they'd spoken with Pharma Bro Shkreli, Martin Shkreli. And he's like, yeah, jail's not so bad. I mean, that's, yeah. Is that really? Yeah. Like, you know, they think, well, I'll go to some sort of, you know, prison camp, minimum security prison camp, get out in a few years, and I've got my pile of cash waiting for me somewhere. I mean, yeah, so buyer beware, I think. It's really unbelievable. I think the thing that was so stunning to me were sort of midway through the book, you have these two victims, one guy, Francis Kim, and someone, Fawaz Ahmed. And on May 19th, 2022, when there was that crash or adjustment, these guys had different strategies across the globe from each other. But the app, one of them's like, they have a short position, and now it's crashed. He wants to like close out the short and make the money. The other one was like, uh-oh, it's going down. I got in early. I've made my money. Let me get out now. Neither of them could get the app to work. And I forget which one this was.
It was Binance. The biggest crypto.
So they just, was that a scam, do you think? Or did the app just not have the capacity because of the trading volume that people were trying to sell?
Impossible to know. You know, yeah. We'll probably find out over legal proceedings and things like that. Well, actually, probably is a perhaps wishful thinking. Maybe we'll find out through those things, but it's impossible to know. It's very difficult in crypto to discern what is purposefully fraudulent behavior and what is incompetence, because, you know, there's a lot of both. And not to correct you, but it was May 2021.
Oh, 2021. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Yeah. There was another crash in May 2022. But the thing that was fascinating about that, right, is that one guy's long, one guy's short. The app shuts down, and it's shut down for a minute. And by the time it comes back on, the price has magically gone back up. And so the guy that was long was instantaneously liquidated. There's no margin calls. He was instantly liquidated. He had made supposedly $10 million, I want to say, worth of Ethereum or something like that. Fawaz, if I'm not mistaken, former Uber driver, living in Toronto, like seems like a really good dude. So he loses all that money. He has to tell his parents, you know, because like he had made all this money theoretically and everything's good. And then he's got, yeah, that was like, oof. And then Francis in Australia was short, and so he's just trying to cash out. And he also, like, the price had gone back up, so most of that money that he'd made in the short was gone, and he just, you know, lost the rest of it. So, like, I mean, I don't know how to sell a more perfect metaphor for, like, how crooked this thing is. That it doesn't matter whether you're long or short. Either way, you lose your money.
Right, the house always wins. Oh. You know, back in the, like... I don't know what there was this expression back in the 50s and 60s when manufactured consumer goods started to be cheaper, and they called it engineered obsolescence. Do you remember hearing this concept?
No. Would you mind explaining that to me?
Instead of making, if you made a toaster or you made an appliance of some other kind or an electronic good that was actually so good that it would last, you would never have that customer again. So engineered obsolescence is, where you build something and so it's either poorly enough made or you suddenly now need something different. And we see this a lot in products where if you always change, you know, you have an iPhone and they're always changing the charger for some reason, you know.
Yeah.
So engineered.
It does happen, surprisingly.
Engineered obsolescence is a thing. And I'm thinking the way you describe this, it's like engineered incompetence. Like it's just you understaff something, you do stuff so that it's be.
Oh yeah, yeah, totally.
Were they pushed or did they jump? It doesn't really matter.
All you're looking for is creating enough gray room where you can't really tell, and that is really helpful for whoever's running the thing.
Before we wrap up, I since he's such a high profile figure, the Sam Bankman-Fried character, I just don't get it. I mean, I don't get why he kept talking to people whether it was Andrew Ross Sorkin after the bankruptcy, or he was speaking with you this summer before, or even now you get this.
Summer of, like, what? The summer of, only 3 months before he, the summer before now, yes.
No, but like, what is he, you know, and then he would, it was like he was very cagey with you when you asked him questions, and he kind of lied. I mean, the thing that struck me about him, because I've seen him some of these interviews, the thing that struck me as an outright lie is when his finance guy was claiming that your account at FTX, which was their trading platform as opposed to their the hedge fund that they were running that were connected, he was saying that your account at FTX was FDIC and SIPC insured, which is just pure bullshit.
Yes.
And you called him on that, and he didn't really admit that he was lying about it. Can you explain that to me?
I mean, it's difficult for me to explain. I go into the detail in the book in terms of like what I saw and what I, you know, my experience. That's, you know, that's all I can do.
Right.
I can't, you know, lying is such an interesting thing, right? Because it's, you can't tell someone's lying in some senses, because you can't accidentally lie in that sense. Like, you have to be. So, but it was pretty misleading, let's say, extremely misleading, to imply effectively that anything on FTX was FDIC insured. And then the cover up was, or the explanation was, no, the bank accounts that you transfer from to give the real money over to FTX, those are FDIC insured. And you're like,
oh,
duh. Like, what are you talking about? Like, everything in an American regulated bank, like, has to be FDIC insured if they have gotten the FDIC, like, whatever. It was just nonsense. And he would, like, you know, they were getting, that was definitely a line that was too far for regulators.
Yeah.
They're like, cut it out. And they made him, you know, send a letter, and like, they had to take it down and change it. And Sam apologized. But then he's DMing me and, like, you know, trying to reposition it. And I'm like, Sam, and he tried to use this language, like, what is, and I'm like, Sam, stop it. Just stop. Like, come on, dude. Like, you, it's, and by the way, you can't blame your lieutenant. You know, it's a tiny little company. You know, your responsibility, you have responsibility here. Like, your responsibility to your customers. I didn't even know what he was doing at the time. You know, I didn't know exactly how, I didn't even know that he was, I couldn't accuse him of any crimes. Like, I,
of course,
my job. I'm a reporter,
right,
journalist guy, actor guy. With, I don't know what I am at this point. you know, but there were a lot of red flags for fraud, and that was one of them, because it's just so shady. It's just crazy.
And before we wrap up, I want to ask you a bit about your collaboration.
Yeah.
So you co-author this with the assistance of Jacob Silverman, and I haven't never really co-authored, or I haven't done much co-authoring. What was that like for the two of you?
It was really interesting. I mean, I can only speak from my experience, but I thought it was, I'm really proud of the book we wrote together. Jacob's a wonderful writer. Great sort of, like, he's funny and also can be kind of strong. Like, he was doing tech for, covering tech for the New Republic. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was kind of generally on a beat of sort of tech, but not necessarily crypto focused specifically. So it was a good meeting in that way, because he knew things that I didn't know, but I knew things. I had gone pretty far down the crypto rabbit hole before I approached him. So, and I have a degree in economics that, you know, he comes from journalism and I think English major, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, very good. He was definitely helping me with the writing and the, you know, let's do it this way. Let's say it this way. But I was trying to say, okay, well, how can we tell these in a way that regular people can understand? Because the problem with economics, you've probably encountered this, is that economics as well has a sort of its own language that mm-hmm. sometimes means what words mean in common parlance, but sometimes doesn't exactly, or things get very technical very quickly. And so the meeting of us was really helpful. And we would just, you know, depend on, you know, we would rewrite it. It worked pretty well. I was surprised. I mean, I'm very proud of what we wrote together.
You know, it's so good. You know, I teach a course every year, and called Money, Law, and Power.
Uh-huh.
And I swap different books in, you know, I start with, and this would be a really, really good book to include in the spring when I teach it again.
I'm
not kidding you.
I would Dahlia love Lithwick that.
I
would love, please, and as we spread the word here, like, you know, if there are professors out there, I really, and look, I'm probably going to regret this promise, but I will definitely you know, maybe I can appear and say hi to the students and talk about it at some point. I
mean, well, say hi to them right now on this podcast, the future students. Just say it right now, and then you've done, then no commitment.
I love it.
All you have to do is say, hi, students in Professor Taub's spring of 2024 Money Law and Power class, and then we're done.
Hello, students of Professor Taub's 2024 Money, what is it called?
Money Law and Power.
Money Law, what a great title.
Thanks.
Should have taken that. I could have. Hello, students of Professor Taub's 2024 Money Law and Power class. I'm Ben McKenzie, and you're reading Easy Money.
Boom, done.
I can't wait.
Do you know,
let's do it. I'll come back.
I had Michael Cohen zoom into my class once.
Whoa, that's cool.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah, dude. I'll totally do it. That sounds awesome.
So fun. Is there anything I forgot to ask you?
No, I mean, look, I can talk about this stuff all day, but like, you know, this was such a wonderful conversation because, it's just a wonderful conversation. You know so much about sort of the building blocks that led me to where I got to. And so once you sort of, sometimes you have to start from the blocks. That's a pun, blockchain.
Oh, ouch. I was going to avoid that.
Sorry about that. I walked right into that. But sometimes you have to start with them, and sometimes you can just start at a slightly higher level and have a different conversation. So it's really rewarding to be able to do that. So thank you. And thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And how do people find you?
Just Google me. I mean, Ben McKenzie, Ben underscore McKenzie, I think is my Twitter handle. Mr. Ben McKenzie is my handle on Insta.
Are you on Threads yet?
Oh, yeah, I'm on Threads.
Right. Okay, who are you on Threads? The same as your Insta.
Same, yeah, Mr. Ben McKenzie. My avatar is Jack London in a kind of a diaper. Like, he's in that. I love it. It's one of my favorite.
Jack London, the author?
Yeah. So Jack London is wearing, he's in this boxing pose, but he's wearing, I don't know what it was, but it's like it looks like an adult diaper. I don't know why people were wearing it at the time. It's a very interesting picture. Anyway, you have to check it out, but that's all description. You can't miss me unless somebody's.
Can I encourage you to maybe have your Ben Franklin with the laser eyes? That's a good idea. Avatar?
I should do it. Saying like, nobody gets it. Stop doing that. And I'm like, I know. I should do it.
Maybe
do Ben Franklin. That's a good idea.
I think you should. Come on, just do that.
Good advice.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jennifer.
That was a fantastic conversation. I was going to get the full scoop from Ben on that little story he couldn't tell me during the recording, but he had to run off. This is a very, very busy week. His book just came out on Tuesday, and I think he's doing round-the-clock radio, podcast, and television interviews. It was so generous of him to spend an hour with us today and to wish my students for in the future class, Money, Law, and Power, hello. And I'll be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Let us know what you think. Send an email to bookedup@politicon.com. You can also write us at bookedup@P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast.